Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now in 2020, events at the institutional end of the UK art world have taken a turn for the worse. In place of the performed attitudes of altruism and progressiveness have now become prevalent and almost sector-wide. Previously, those on the receiving end of such behaviours had to suffer in isolation. But now, the specific conditions of this year have brought institutional cruelties out into the open. Whether it's mass redundancies at the Tate and the South Bank Centre, or the gaslighting of a black employee at London's ICA, at every turn, curators, directors and trustees made decisions that placed themselves first and artists and arts professionals last. In this episode, I'll be looking into some specific instances of this dynamic. I'll be talking to Rumour of Waves about their refusal to accept the blacklisting of an artist at Tate and curator Linda Rocco about her brilliant independent work. But first, now in the bizarre twilight zone of British institutional monoculture, there's a special category of odd reserved for so-called minority organisations in the sector that employ little or no staff from the respective minorities they're supposed to represent. One of the weirdest examples of this I've come across is the Centre for Chinese Contemporary Art in Manchester. Earlier in the decade, my initial feeling of surprise at the discovery of the CFCCA doubled when I realised almost none of the staff working there were either British-born Chinese or from China. What some might write off as a unique instance of institutional gatekeeping is harder to dismiss in a British sector characterised by what seems to be the sustained overlook of British Chinese artists and arts professionals. I recently came across Rising Bun, a group of artists who are highlighting these discrepancies both at the centre and in the wider art world, and invited artists Si Kum Chung, JJ Chan and curator Tiffany Leung onto the show to talk about the situation. Si Kum, could you tell me a bit about the group? Who is in it and how did you form?
So we are just a recent group of people. We're sort of a East and Southeast Asian descent. Most of us have had a relationship with CFCCA, either as artists or as staff members. And we just formed very recently, actually, sort of at the beginning of this year. During round about the COVID times, actually, and we came together first of all to speak about the weird experiences that we had all had with CFCCA and the problems that we'd experienced there, and then to actually think about sort of new places or spaces where we could actually develop work that was on more favorable terms. But was a way to like forge more positive relationships than the ones that we had experienced with this institution.
So how did the situation with the CFCCA develop? Because was it something where you all knew each other before and you all arrived at this realization that something needed to change at the same time? Or was it that you each individually came into contact with the organization and it was a kind of cumulative process of like discovering that there were things that needed to be addressed?
Yeah, it was definitely cumulative. So the first person that I'd actually met was Will Pham, who I'd met through your screening project last year in October. And we met up actually because it was the first time that I'd met a British Vietnamese artist who shared a similar background to myself. And he told me that he was in this show with CFCCA that was going to open around about April the following year. And he wanted to introduce me to the curator, who was Tiffany Leung. So he asked if I was happy to have that connection. And I said, okay, let's give it a go. Why not? And it was for a show titled A New Constellation, Chinese Diaspora Now. And that was scheduled for 24th of April to 12th of July 2020. It was through a series of things that happened as a consequence of being invited into that show, which included meeting the curator, Tiffany Long, having a wonderful conversation with her, and then seeing that she was suddenly going to depart in February 2016. That was 2 months before the opening of her show. It was a sudden departure, and I think that's what triggered off a series of problems that we started to notice from within CFCCA itself. That's how JJ got in touch with me. It's how I reached out to Tiffany as well to see if she was okay. It's also how we connected with the other artists and other associates. It also led to JJ's open letter and an article in Asia Art Pacific. And the conversations keep on evolving on from there, basically.
Now, to develop a picture for listeners who may not be familiar with the CFCCA, who is the institution accountable to? And I guess maybe one of the ways we can figure that out is it publicly funded?
Yes, it's publicly funded, but actually maybe I can give this question over to JJ because he's been thinking a lot about this.
CFCCA is primarily, from what I understand, funded by the Arts Council. And it also gets funding from a few other places, but majority of their income comes from the Arts Council funding that they receive. So yes, they're accountable to the public.
So I think one of the strange things about this organisation is that not many people know about it. I was completely surprised and taken aback when I found out it existed. And then I was sort of blown away by how shadowy the organisation seems. Like when you go on the website, there's not even a history of exhibitions that have been on there. Even though they're accountable to Arts Council England, it almost seems to me, well, they're accountable to the public and Arts Council England. It doesn't seem to me that they're engaging either one on the terms that you might identify as sort of progressive or favourable. Is that your experience as well? Because I also wondered about how the CFCCA, what their relationship is with, let's say, the Chinese community in Manchester, but beyond that in the rest of the UK.
Well, I think it's important to remember that also this is the only Chinese art centre in Europe. And although it is a small institution and relatively unknown to, let's say, the general public, it has on paper a really significant place. When we're thinking or talking about artists of the Chinese diaspora, a European institution that represents artists who are of Chinese heritage from across Asia and across the world. So on paper, this is an institution that is perhaps sort of as the leading authority. And there was a period last year that they were claiming to be that. The power that they have is in influence. And they can influence people's perspective of what it means to be Chinese from China, what China is, what being Asian is, and also what it means to exist as those things in the UK.
Now, let's talk a bit about your open letter. So I think in response to some of these issues that you came across with the institution, you penned an open letter. And what was interesting to me about it was that it wasn't just like a declarative document, but it was actually, let me just take one of the sentences from it. It was not a call to boycott, but to engage. Why was it important to make that distinction for you?
For me, a boycott was to step away from that situation. And that was a situation that one I felt like I couldn't step away from because it was a situation that kind of took over me. It wasn't a situation that I chose to be in. And it was then a situation that I couldn't choose to step away from. It would impact me whether or not I was engaging or not. And so it was a call for other people to join me in attempting to unravel, understand this. And in a way, it was a kind of, that open letter was me putting out a honing signal and saying, does anybody else, can anybody offer me anything on this? Because I'm not sure what I'm thinking or saying is right. They're telling me that I'm misunderstanding the situation, and I'm not in a position to be able to think about that rationally at the moment because I'm fueled by anger, I'm fueled by frustration, I'm confused, And that's where that letter came from. But I think, just as Seacombe was speaking, I was just thinking back to 2019 as well. And if I could just take you back to September 2019, so a year ago since now, and that's when Tiffany had approached me to do this show. I've been speaking to Tiffany now since I was a student, actually, since we were both students, and we've been trying to figure out ways that we can work together. And so that's been an ongoing conversation. But in November, when I was asked, I felt that 2019 was already a really tumultuous year. And I remember writing this at the end of the year. And I was saying that, everybody is up in uncertainty. Donald Trump was just impeached. Brexit was all over the place. Hong Kong was in a really, it continues to be in a really tumultuous situation. And these things were like bearing down on me at that point. And I wanted to make this work that would try to figure out what my place was within that. And from a perspective of being Chinese and being in Britain. And, me and Tiffany shared that. And don't think I could make that work with any other curator, someone who I could share an anxiety with, and then it forms into something productive that we understood from a way that we couldn't quite even articulate in words. So building on that, and I felt like I was in a safe space to be able to make that work. By the time it got to February, Tiffany had to leave CFCCA. And when Tiffany left CFCCA, I was like, okay, well, who am I going to work with now? This is a new commission and it's not finished. So we've got to continue a relationship. And then I was talking to the other team members at CFCCA. I was trying to figure out where this work would go. And so I asked them, why do you want to work with me? Why do you want this work? And then we can figure out how I can finish it off. And they couldn't give me an answer. And I suppose that was the point where I realized that something wasn't quite right. And I started then, I was visiting the studio every night, staring at the blank wall and not being able to finish the work because I didn't know where it was going. I didn't know what it was for. I didn't know why these people were interested in it, what their agenda was. There was suddenly no trust. That relationship didn't exist anymore. And so the space for that work was kind of taken away. And then I started to think more about it. I started to have really long conversations on the phone with various people, the director, senior curator. And I was unpicking these conversations. And I just got to a position where I was so distressed by it that I had to, the show opening was approaching and I just couldn't make the work. And so I had to put into writing, and I wrote that letter really quickly in about maybe two evenings. I remember writing, I had a conversation with Seacombe on the phone and I said to her, I think I might write an open letter. And we had like a 4-hour discussion. And then two evenings later, I sent it out before she got a chance to read it. And it was just that urgency of needing to, it was like trying to just like open a window or something so that I can get some fresh air. And that's where that letter came from.
Okay, so I think this is probably a good moment to bring Tiffany in as somebody who's really central to this whole sort of process. So Tiffany, your experience at CFCCA is slightly different to JJ and Seacombe's in that you were assistant curator there. So you were inside from the beginning. What were the events that led to your eventual departure from the CFCCA in February?
It's quite hard to really summarize, I think, everything in terms of what led to my final decision of leaving. But, I was there for 2 years and it was my first full-time role in the arts. And during my last few months, it became clear to me that I did not feel aligned with the organization and their ethos. And at the same time, it was also becoming an increasingly hostile environment to work in. And kind of, you know, that it got to a point where I wasn't willing to compromise anymore. And, you know, it was a really tough decision because at the time I was working on this group show, you know, mentioned by Seacom and JJ just now, which, you know, it was very personal to me as well. You know, it was an emotional experience developing the show with the artists. And it was something that I, you know, it was very close to my heart. And so it was a tough decision to leave at that moment. And I felt, you know, I definitely felt like, oh, you know, am I leaving the artists behind? But it got to a point where I just wasn't able to handle it anymore. And, you know, it was a real big relief when I was able to walk away. And you know, this experience had left me quite traumatized, really. Like, I felt vulnerable and exhausted for a very long time. You know, we're now in October, and you know, it was February when I left, and I still kind of feel the emotion when I speak about it. You know, it's been months of healing, you know, particularly having these bi-weekly chat with Zikan, JJ, and the other artists, you know, but it's something that I'm still trying to process.
I think what seems so strange to me from the outside is the way that maybe an institution that's not necessarily fulfilling its duties to its best abilities is really gripping onto the institution with both hands and not letting go. That refusal to surrender the reins to people who might be more suitable, or to just give the space over to people who might be more suitable, is resulting in these sort of abusive behaviours and procedures of gaslighting and leading to people feeling disenfranchised. So I think the organisation began, if I'm right, like around, was it 1987? Not necessarily as a CFCCA, but as a Chinese art centre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by now, it should be a major institution in the UK, a major institution. If that's the only spot you can go to that's dedicated to Chinese contemporary art, it should be doing talks and events that people are travelling up to Manchester for. I mean, was that really frustrating to you to see that there's all this potential there, and but people refusing to do it, number one, and possibly just not having the ability to do it, number two?
Yeah, it wasn't just me, it's me and also other staff in the organization that were not in the managerial role. We, you know, over the 2 years, like I said, it wasn't kind of, you know, a one-off incident that led to my decision of leaving the organization. It was definitely accumulated. And I think over time, as I gained more confidence and experience, and I felt like, at the same time, my impact on the organization's direction was actually diminishing. It was very frustrating. And I think, you know, I felt like, you know, this resources belong to us. It belonged to, you know, people with agency, and that, like, you know, that it mattered to, and it wasn't doing that.
So I'd like to maybe let's bring everybody back in again, because there's a sentence in your open letter, JJ, that I think really spoke to the kind of surreal odd situation that a lot of, I think, so-called minority communities find themselves in. Now, I say so-called because, well, we all come from the majority parts of the world. But the sentence was, perhaps it's not surprising to most people that many of the dominant voices in conversations in the UK about Chinese arts are white voices. Why do you feel it might not be surprising to people?
Well, I think maybe let's go back to you, because I think you made a really important point earlier about people holding on to an institution, even if they perhaps feel, even themselves feel, that they don't have the expertise. And maybe that's the case also with knowledge, right? So these publications, books, exhibitions, these are affirmations of someone's intelligence, their knowledge. And there is then perhaps a sense of vulnerability to letting that go. And maybe we can even refer to that as white fragility. And so there is this suddenly a destabilization of that when at various points, and it's not just happening now, you know, it's happened before, it happens simultaneously in different places, and it triggers something that, you know, that destabilization triggers something that doesn't take the platform away from somebody, but in fact in a way reinforces it. Because what it does is someone with power, and whether that's power that they've gained or just happen to have, when they feel a sense of fragility, they need to develop security mechanisms around themselves. And so that might be seeking academic qualifications, promotions, or whatever, and they then create this kind of fort around themselves that strengthens that position, actually. And actually, those things are more difficult to gain if you're marginalized. Now, you know, even if we think about our institutions now, they are still, most of our institutions are still run by men, white men. And so even as a white woman, you might feel marginalized. And then, you do feel marginalized. And so when it comes to intersectional inequalities, those things are doubly, triply, quadruply on top of you to get those qualifications, to get promotions, to get certain things, letters after your name or whatever. And I think the situation has got to a stage where it's become rather arbitrary, actually, how these positions are filled. But it's not arbitrary how they're kept in the way. They're in a stasis on purpose, and that's the holding on.
I'd like to know or get a sense of what's happening in the future. What are you trying to push CFCCA towards?
Well, at this point, we are in conversation with the board, and that includes like the chair, the vice chair, and also a trustee. And these people, they have heard our full story, including the stories of the other artists who we are also representing, because they have either not been available to participate or weren't comfortable in participating in that conversation. So to sort of summarize, this includes the misidentification of their heritage, the misgendering of their backgrounds and their identity. It also includes the hostile environments in which they have been creating to host these artists and also these staff members. So at this point, they are looking outside for experts to actually help them steer the board on how to work with the information that we're providing for them. It's quite hard for us to know what this institution is going to do. But we can say that various shows have all been cancelled by the artists themselves for all this year.
Wait, so the artists themselves have cancelled the shows?
Yes. The shows that were meant to open after COVID were cancelled by the artists themselves. And this was a consequence of a number of reasons, for personal reasons, personal problems with the institution themselves, but also pressure from external journalists asking why they haven't cancelled in line with JJ's open letter. There is also this artist co-revisioning group, which some artists are participating in, but that's also where a large group of us had a big discussion about whether we felt we could participate in it, whether that was just going to be a Arts Council funding tick box exercise, and whether any of our concerns were going to be met, considering they haven't met them already before on a personal level with all these people. So that's where we all declined, actually. So that's what's going on right now, is that there is this group that's working within the institution, but they're not the group that we were speaking to, which are a large group, and of which had recent relationships with them and long relationships with the institution as well. So it's hard to say. But I agree with you. I hadn't heard of this institution before Will told me about it and before Tiffany invited me. And from an embodied perspective, I have noticed that, for example, during COVID-19, that institution was silent. And it's because the urgency didn't meet their bodies in the same ways as it had met ours, which is also why so many of us came together. It also made it very clear as to why we needed people who also embodied the same issues as us, because you cannot feel what we are experiencing and you cannot know the urgency to speak up for it if you are not that person. So it's an ongoing long conversation, of course, but if they fail even at the basic levels of good stewardship, good curatorial practice, then they're in they're not in a very stable place, I think.
It's funny because I was trying to think, like, if some people are finding it's difficult to get their heads around, maybe they should consider an institution of like a Caribbean or African contemporary art staffed completely by white people. But then I thought, actually, those places exist. I think we're in a situation where at one point there was this notion of kind of plausible deniability. What you could say is, well, there just aren't enough people around. We couldn't find a curator of color. You know, there's no directors of color, unfortunately. That was always a fiction. And now it's, and the institution have been caught in that lie. You know, they're holding on to it anyway. You know, that what they should be doing is stepping aside. If somehow they all left next week, what would be the ideal outcome going into the future?
I mean, that already sounds like an ideal outcome to me. We have talked about this as a group, in terms of discussing what could have been, what it should be. And instead we formed our own autonomous group. We don't put on exhibitions, we don't have a program, but what we do is kind of facilitating this network and relationship, that's like a place of care and trust. And I think that should be kind of one of the fundamentals of organization of this nature, or really any art organization and more. So I think I really, I think being in such different worlds, working in an institution that was so hostile, and then coming out of that and then forming this friendship with, all these, we call ourselves the Rising Bands. And it really showed me how I think the possibility of coming together. And I've been, thinking a lot about, in terms of, not just CFCCA, but now we see a lot of organizations that are being called out recently. I think off the back of the, the Black Lives Matter movement and kind of having this global traction. And I think people, it's not really news, but now we're really starting to see these institutions and places that claim to be radical or have very kind of critical sounding program. But I think now we're calling out this kind of hypocrisy we see, and this, this facade of what they put on, and compared to how they treat the staff, how they treat their artists. And I think, I might be getting a bit off track, but I think maybe, like, what I kind of the end goal to not have that. I think, the it should reflect with, within the organization, the ethos and how people are treated. You can't really, it kind of you can't really say you're doing things on to public, and then in the inside, in the organization, it's, it's not, it's the complete opposite.
Often we everybody actually places the blame on institutions as a whole, as though the institution is this kind of like a godlike creature. But actually, you've got to remember that institutions are made of individuals, right? Had there be, if the individuals were separated, there would be no institution. So, there is, yes, there's a curatorial duty of care, which is a professional one, which is what institutions are paid to do, but there's also a need for those individuals to care on a personal capacity, because in the way that we care about these issues, right, we need, and I'm just thinking back to last week when I saw people posting a picture of Maria Bolshaw on a beach in Dungeness, and her reaction was that, you know, I care, but, you know, I've worked solidly for 3 months and I need a holiday. And actually, sure, she cares in a personal capacity as much as her professional duty of care asks of her, but in a personal capacity, does she care? And I think what we need is people who genuinely have a personal interest, a personal care and urgency in themselves to sort out this mess. And the way that we do that is that we have to somehow, it requires a complete change of mind, a complete change of perspective, a real life, an ontological shift in the way that we see it ourselves, see ourselves in relation to other people, or the rest of the world. And if that doesn't happen, all of these things, all of these initiatives that institutions are doing are satisfying only these kind of surface level professional institutional goals, and they're actually not changing society. They're not actually changing the way that we see each other, how we coexist. And I think that's the issue, and it is personal and it is individual, and it might be institutional, but, you know, institutions only exist because of a mass of individuals.
That was Seekum Chung, JJ Chan and Tiffany Leung talking about monoculture and gatekeeping at the Centre for Chinese Contemporary Art in Manchester. Now, amidst a torrent of open letters that were duly ignored by the institutions they addressed, another group's willingness to back up their convictions with action caught my attention. Artist Amy Sharrocks was invited by Tate to devise a programme in response to, and I say this without any irony, their 2020 theme of love. To do this, Amy invited Madeline Colley, Nando Messias and Jade Montserrat to form a group called Rumour of Waves. Then, after months of planning, Amy received a call from Tate curator Cara Courage, informing her that Tate would not allow them to work with Jade Montserrat and that Jade was effectively blacklisted from the Tate. Now, I want to be clear about this. The actual discrimination and singling out of a single artist represents a significant escalation in punitive institutional muscle flexing. And it's a development that affects us all, because if they can do it to one of us, they can do it to all of us. Earlier this week, I caught up with Amy to find out what happened and began by asking her to describe events from the point curator Cara Courage delivered the news of Jade's blacklisting.
Cara rings me and says, "You can't work with Jade Montserrat." It's a very quick conversation. I burst into tears and I go, "Well, of course you can't mean that. I can't work with you." Then she goes, "You need to speak to the person that, you know, further in charge." And I say, "Yes, I do." So we then have a long conversation that evening. It's an hour and a half Zoom, which they begin, luckily, Anna Cutler, begins by saying, "Of course we want you to work with whoever you want to work with. We wouldn't dream of telling you not to." And I'm like, "Oh, thank goodness." But she then goes on to explain that her introduction is all about Anthony Doffé and how in 2017, Jade put up this really disturbing image of Anthony with a gollywog and accused him of racial and sexual harassment. She tells me the story of how Tate, in her work, you know, in her opinion, they did everything they could to distance themselves from Anthony, but they faced a barrage of litigation from his lawyers. They said that his lawyers bombarded them with emails, so much so that they could not do their institutional work. And so that they did everything that they could, but that their trustees would not let them do any more than they had done, that they had stopped relations with him, but they couldn't do any more. She was very clear that she believed Jade. Cara believed Jade, and Maria Balshaw also, when I spoke with her later in the week, also explained that she believed Jade. But they said that they had no evidence apart from these testimonies, and because of that, their trustees made it clear that this was hearsay, and that on reflection with their whole trustee board and their ethics board, that they were absolutely not allowing them to do anything further. And actually it became apparent across the week that not only could they not distance themselves further from Anthony, but they had insisted that they resumed contact with Anthony because there was no legal reason not to. And I think they had in the discussions with me, they kept mentioning how there were two world-class lawyers on their ethics board. And personally speaking, it feels like they have made a confusion between legalities and ethics. But they reiterated to me that they couldn't do any more than they had done. The trustees wouldn't let them. And that for this reason, they couldn't work with Jade. And I said, well, obviously that's got nothing to do with what we were doing. Our work has nothing to do with Anthony. Our work, Jade was going to talk with Catherine Yusuf about the geology of this planet and the race politics of time that are layered in the geological strata of our world. This was not about Anthony. And I objected to the fact that actually this was a limiting of Jade's art and artistic practice. How could they limit her to only discussions of this man? This is not what she was talking about. This was unfair. They needed to not do this. I couldn't collude in this erasure, and we had to find a way through to help her speak.
Why was it then important for you to withdraw, as opposed to, say, writing a strongly worded letter saying you disapprove of this action, but then continuing to work for Tate?
Well, it all goes a bit further. I have a second conversation with Anna and Cara, in which they give me a whole other reason for excluding Jade. They point to a newspaper article and they say, we are now, because of this newspaper article, we're in a whole different legal situation. So it is they begin to create whole other reasons for not working with Jade, which really begins to scare me. And I ask to speak to Maria Balshaw, who also maintains this line that Jade is hostile to Tate, not critical, but hostile. And she then brings up the fact that they've received hostile messages, that there is a kind of a safeguarding issue. But each time finishing with a plan to move forward together to just work out the questions of hosting that Tate are having difficulties with, that I offer to make the whole program a space of private learning, that if their fears are around publicity and this public interface between this kind of legal history of Anthony, that actually maybe we can find a new generative space for conversation, but we can make it private. So I offer to make the whole program private and just a space for private learning. But we end all these conversations with a kind of a plan to move forward together. We are, as my understanding is, that we are working towards hosting Jade. Unfortunately, then on the following Wednesday, I get a final phone call from Kara, who says, actually, with another reason, she says, actually, Jade has sent hostile messages to members of staff, so we can't work with her. It's a safeguarding issue. And I'm like, what is the timeline of these messages? Is it recent? Is it over 3 years? Is it, what do you mean? She goes, well, we're building a dossier again of her actions, and we'll share it with you if we can.
Wow.
It's just horrible to imagine that the actions of our greatest cultural organization that are supposed to be welcoming in artists, that are supposed to be led by artists. I found an article that I'd kept of Maria Balshaw when she begins at Tate from 2017, where she says she wants Tate to be led by artists. But in fact, they are compiling a dossier against artists. I mean, it's just, it's been so shocking. And so reductive of what our museums and art galleries can be. What is the action that we need our museums and art galleries to be in this world, in this kind of world of crisis? Because it is not this.
I think what you did was brilliant, and I think what you did was really important, especially because at the moment there's a lot of people penning, you know, open letters and then just not doing anything. And I really think for directors of institutions, there's a separation. People don't actually know them. You know, so I think there's a lot of projection of, oh, maybe they're like this, maybe they're like that. But they really sit at a distance from artists, and they really sometimes have quite a condescending relationship to artists, the same way curators do. Yeah. So they'll be sitting somewhere saying, look, they're not really going to do anything. They're all going to say in this open letter that they disprove, but then they'll work with us anyway. So I think it's a really important, you know, I think it's really important.
I think they really tried that. I think they kept sending me emails going, we really want to work with you. And it was really disgusting that actually they thought that it would be okay. You know, it was impossible to imagine continuing a work of love if I could just erase Jade from the program. So we completely refused. In response to this suggestion that I continue with my contractual obligations, we sent them a long letter refusing to continue the work without Jade.
And I don't want to sound patronising, Amy, but I just think, well done. I just want to say well done. The notion of solidarity has become so debased, it feels like such an empty, like it's almost people feel like they can just say the word, but solidarity involves your own emotional and personal risk, you know, that's the whole point in it.
You know, it was pretty intolerable. And when you're threatened with legal action, you know, I didn't know if I was going to have to repay all the money I've paid other people and myself with over a year and a half. You know, was that actually by refusing, was I going to be, you know, what did that even mean? You know, actually financially for everybody. You know, there were lots of other considerations, but actually, however intolerable and difficult it was for me, the idea of this whole institution aiming squarely at Jade, against Jade, that this sense of the whole architecture of the building is an architecture of exclusion against one artist because of their fear. This kind of, they'd worked her up into an idea of her as an explosive, difficult thing that, you know, and I just, it was so appalling that they, you know, so however hard it was for me, it was harder for her, and it's so not should how our institutions should behave. you know, it's just a repeating of all the stories we've always known, we've had for 400 years. You know, it's just, we need what Donna Haraway said, an ethic of flourishing. You know, we need take to world new worlds. And instead, they repeated this same old trope, rich white men, you know, and the exclusion of women and people of colour. It's just can't be repeated, has to be a different story. There's a brilliant quote from Aditi Jagannathan in a poem. She says, to love is to refuse. And I think that is what it came down to for us. I refuse the conditions they set for our work. I refuse these constant erasures and a continuance of an exploitative work practice.
That was Amy Sharrocks discussing the Tate blacklisting of artist Jade Montserrat. Over the course of lockdown, one thing has been blindingly clear. All the interesting, exciting and innovative work in the field has been done by artists outside of large-scale institutions. While places like Chisenhale, Serpentine, the ICA and Tate try to scramble together programmes on care, it's been the smaller institutions, individual artists and collectives who have devised talks, screened works, offered funds and support that address the wants and needs of artists and arts audiences. My last guest this week is part of that group. For the past few years, I've been following the activity of emerging London-based curator Linda Rocco. And around the start of lockdown, Linda, along with her curatorial partner Reen Bernardino, launched their brilliant and ambitious project, Where I'm Coming From, a group exhibition focusing on artists who spoke either Filipino, Taiwanese, Tamil or Berber languages. I spoke to Linda and began by asking her to tell me how far into the project they were before they realised they had to take it online.
We kind of discovered it basically after a year since the beginning, the kind of application process, because it was supposed to be in a real space, kind of in a gallery setting. And it was supposed to be an exhibition that kind of unfolds over time. But then COVID happened, and we had to kind of rethink on how to deliver the program anyway. In that case, we had more support from Inka Shonibare Studio, because they kind of supported the shift from the gallery space to a digital platform. So they luckily had some kind of, you know, financial support to deliver the program anyway. And so that we had to kind of just rethink on how to engage the same artists, which was quite difficult because they were supposed to have real, you know, physical works in space and now digital. So it's not that we could choose, you know, kind of a new selection of artists. Obviously we wanted to honor the artists we were working with. So that was quite tricky to find ways to still present a good, valuable work into a digital space. And then finding ways to engage beyond, you know, kind of the usual art audience, trying to, obviously we use translations so that we could reach more people. But then, you know, with the digital, especially with countries kind of very far, because obviously the languages were specific to very particular countries, there's lots of limitations with the internet and access to social media. So for instance, lots of people could maybe see posts but couldn't open, you know, the link to get on a website and see the work.
It struck me that Where I'm Coming From was one of the most original exhibitions or exhibition ideas that I've heard of this year. How did the project originally come together?
It was a discussion between myself and Rai Bernardino, who is my co-director in this organization that now is an organization, but was born as a collective at the RCA when we were starting. She's a performance artist. And the idea was to really tap into communities that are not necessarily involved in the arts, especially in the UK, and really kind of trying to find artists that were interesting and were really dealing with language in this case, from countries that we never heard of almost, you know. So we really looked into the demographies first of the languages highly spoken in the UK by migrant communities. And then we paired the languages with kind of a huge research on artists, both in London, but also in their original country. And that was a long process to kind of find, you know, artists that could speak Yoruba, Taiwanese, Berber, and Filipino. And then after that, was looking into partners, local partners to the language as well, to kind of bring the program a bit more to life. And then we also involved for each language group, kind of a community group to deliver cooking sessions. So it was community groups or artist studios. We tried to find groups that, you know, were already together, that maybe we used to cook together and share this kind of process to show us and just share the traditions and you know, such a simple thing, which is cooking, can be very insightful actually. And so it was to bring a bit more of the culture into the program, basically, beyond the artworks.
What I found exciting about your project was that there was a real sense of the international, and the international through language. And oftentimes in the art world, the international is kind of like a euphemism for Europe and North America. And then even when they do look at artists from, let's say, less visited regions, they're always the same artist. I was super, super excited when I came across this project. Now, was language an important thing because you and your exhibition partner, you're not sort of native English speakers. So did that play a factor in you thinking about language?
Well, to me, I see language as a barrier. So I'm really interested in accessibility, making us accessible by, you know, from kind of barriers in terms of disability, but also all sorts of barriers that could exist. And in this sense, language is a huge one, you know. I remember Fries a couple of years ago seeing a piece that was saying that if you don't speak English, you're not an artist, you know, which I always found kind of funny because this is a big restriction, you know. If you don't speak English, you're somehow, you know, at the limit of the debate. And as you said, there's very few artists from those countries that are known, you know, Filipino, Medalla. But then after Medalla, you know, it was almost 30 years ago, and you go to the biennial, Medalla is still there, which is great. But, you know, there's huge, incredible artists that do very interesting things just beyond Europe and America. And sometimes you really find as well really kind of cool ideas, new stuff, you know, things that are really refreshing. And that's what we're looking for, kind of, you know, go beyond the language barrier and then knowing more about the language itself, because, you know, certain languages look beautiful and they have beautiful stories, beautiful sound. They are getting somehow lost, you know, they are not maybe, it's not possible to transcribe them, to write them down. So it was also like, it was a huge, you know, kind of research into making visible something that would maybe go unnoticed or it's not very well considered normally.
What's so exciting about you is that you do come up with these exciting ideas, and sometimes I think, well, is that that's part of your sort of functioning independently? Institutions really tie curators to some notion of public engagement that's based on a public that's ignorant and not really interested in anything. Yeah. Whereas I think your project tapped into something that we've all felt, I think, that sense of enchantment with other languages. As soon as you learn a tiny little bit about them, they're really beautiful and incredible. Yeah. So is independent something that you want to stay and you've strived to be? Is that something that you feel like you'll continue to operate?
Totally, totally.
And why is it important for you?
Well, it's a tricky one in the sense that, you know, when I finished my MA, it was a question I kind of asked myself. You know, I was seeing lots of peers going into curatorial assisting roles that are, you know, kind of not very well paid. And, you know, you end up to do kind of admin jobs. And I knew I had lots of ideas, and I had, you know, as well, really this drive to engage with a public that is not generally, you know, the art, necessarily the art audience, and, you know, artists that are not already on top there, but they maybe have loads of things to give at the bottom. And so, and I found myself thinking that, you know, in institutions, there's first of all, the institutions are inflexible, you know, the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, having these bigger agendas that rule the program or the exhibition you're doing, often, you know, tied to the funding bodies. It's a difficult position. I found myself instead being independent, you know, having ideas, obviously working hard to make that happen, you know, applying for fundings, emailing, you know, everybody to kind of the right bodies to have partnerships, you know, really kind of digging deep into how to make things happen. And it has been successful. And this as well gave me the chance to move between more public domain and private ones. So for instance, it's a year now that I do consultancy for the GLA, the Greater London Authority, on how to engage disabled artists or neurodiverse. And then I also work for some galleries, so more private. So, you know, I can also have that point of view and knowing more about collectors, even though I kind of, you know, I'm a bit distant from the commercial side of the profession, but still I have an eye on that and I recognize that is important. And having the freedom to really work on what I want and research deeply when I want, you know, working from home, doing meetings all over, like it's really this flexibility I'm really fond of, because I feel like I'm doing something that interests me, you know, and it's really bringing people in, kind of widening, because otherwise it's also a bit boring. I mean, you know what I mean? Even working with artists that are already there, you know, big, huge artists. I mean, it's incredible, of course, like who doesn't want to work with a superstar, you know? But at the same time, as you know, the curatorial job, I think it's more than, you know, producing, admin, and that kind of things, you know? I think it's much more. So by being independent, I really feel like I can explore and experiment as well, which is the basis, you know, experiment. Sometimes things can go wrong as well, but it's part of the game, I guess.
Being sort of flexible and being able to move quite quickly and definitely between positions is really important. But also another way of looking at it is to say that you're incredibly busy. But it always seems to me to be the case that what enables independent curators like yourself to do things like that or to operate with kind of superhuman levels of energy is because you're really interested and the jobs you're doing are stimulating you, as opposed to the curator you meet at an institution who is just tired, who really doesn't like their job, who has really interesting ideas and never gets to work on them.
Totally.
With that in mind, with interesting projects in mind, what have you got coming up in the future?
So I'm right now delivering Celsius, which is lasting a week. It started on Monday and finished on Saturday. And it's a whole program in partnership with the Antarctica Trust. It was commissioned by Mansions of the Future in Lincolnshire. Again, was supposed to happen in real space, but now it's digital. And it's a program focusing on the intersection of art and science with a focus on climate change and the unique position of Antarctica. And we started with a symposium with some incredible people, Wellcome's collection director, studio authors, artists, scientists, incredible. And then we have some performances coming up with some high-tech kind of gloves to produce music, and a focus as well on mental health and the impact of climate change on mental health. So that's this week. And then in October, opening on the 16th, I have a duo show in a gallery in central London, in Tottenham, Loggia Riad. And it's with two Filipino artists that both live in Europe. And it's quite of a peculiar duo show. Again, it's in a commercial gallery, so it's very much looking into the context. But there's some interesting works and tricks that are kind of are comment to the space where they are, basically. And then I'm also doing a kind of a new digital collage project that started in March, is lasting a year, and it's kind of an open call with Italian curator Fabio Paris, where we invite digital artists to send over abstract collage compositions. And we put them all kind of in our Instagram profile and a website. And then at the end of a year, we'll have this huge archive of all this experimentation, and a jury will select the best one for a group show to happen at Galerie Charlot in Paris and in a gallery in London as well. So that's it, more or less. Well, I'm also working with the Goethe Institute in another project, Arts and Science, around the UK in 6 locations. So it's lots on the plates, because obviously, you know, you said I'm busy, but it's a good busy. And it's all going towards the same line. So that's very good and motivating.